Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People, a report on Pope Francis's general audience on Ash Wednesday, where he says Lent is a journey of hope, but warns we don't go to paradise in a carriage. Promoting peace amidst war, a leading Franciscan updates us on the situation in South Sudan, a war-torn nation that the Pope has once again said he wishes to visit. And our Lenten journey. We have two reflections to mark this season of Lent. Francis has described Lent as a journey of hope, but at the same time has warned that we don't go to paradise in a carriage. His words came during his catechesis on Christian hope, during the general audience held on Ash Wednesday. Linda Bordoni reports.
Pope Francis reflected on the experience of the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, in which the chosen people journeyed towards the promised land, and said that the scriptures tell of a tormented journey that symbolically lasted 40 years, the time span of a generation, and that difficulties and obstacles represented continuous temptations to turn back. But he said the Lord stayed close to the people who finally arrived in the promised land, guided by Moses. Their journey, he explained, was undertaken in hope, and in this sense it is an exodus out of slavery and into freedom.
Ogni passo, ogni fatica, ogni prova,
every step, every effort, every test, every fall and every recovery has a sense within God's design for salvation. As the Pope said, he wants life, not death, and joy, not pain, for his people. And speaking of Jesus' own exodus on the way of the cross that allows us to share in his victory over sin and death, Francis said, this doesn't mean that he did everything and we don't have to do anything.
Questo non vuol dire che lui...
It doesn't mean he went through the cross and we will go to heaven in a carriage. That is not, he said, how it works.
Andiamo in paradiso in carrozza. No, non vuol dire questo. Non è così.
Our salvation, the Pope said, is Jesus' gift, but it is part of a love story and requires our yes and our participation. With a heart open to this horizon, the Pope concluded, let us enter into Lent, feeling that we belong to the holy people of God. May we begin our journey of hope with joy. I'm Linda Bordoni.
Could we see a papal visit this year to South Sudan, an African nation gripped by war and famine? That's the question being asked after Pope Francis once again expressed his desire to travel to South Sudan, together with the leader of the Anglican Communion, Archbishop Justin Welby. Meanwhile, on the ground in South Sudan, churches of different denominations, including the Catholic and Anglican churches, which count the largest followings, are urging the people to put aside their differences and engage in dialogue and nation building. Father Michael Perry is the Minister General of the Order of the Friars Minor and has just returned from a visit to the South Sudanese capital, Juba. He told Linda Bordoni that the church-driven process for peace-building and reconciliation is firmly rooted in Sudanese soil and is being strongly pushed there.
You've heard, of course, that the Pope himself let slip that he too intends to perhaps make a journey in sign of solidarity and encouragement. How powerful would a gesture such as this be? How needed is it?
I think we're at a moment right now where people are certainly confronting life and death. They're confronting hope and despair. what I find in the South Sudanese, whatever particular affiliation, religious affiliation they have, my experience with them is they are people who are resilient. They're not forever resilient because of the conditions really can wear them down, but I think they would very much appreciate, I think they're praying for a visit. And I think what's important is what the Pope said. The Pope said, if I come, it would be very important that I come with the Archbishop of Canterbury, because these are the two significant churches in South Sudan. And I think the ecumenical witness to demonstrate that we can live even though we have differences, even though we are not all the same, that we don't share necessarily the same roots, ethnic roots, that we don't share the same identical religious convictions, but that this would be a tremendous witness, and I think it would be a sign of hope and perhaps even an invitation to all leaders and to all people involved who have the possibility to construct a nation for peace. Perhaps this would be also a moment for them, a moment when they could stop and take account of what's going on.
He was actually answering a question that regarded the vitality of young churches and how ecumenism is especially forceful. How do the churches work together in South Sudan?
Very interesting. Since the 1960s in Sudan, the churches have had a particular relationship. It's gone through vagaries. It's had moments when it's been stronger and weaker for different reasons, internal to each of the churches, the Christian churches, and also dependent on the situation in general, the social climate, where there's violence, more violence or less violence. But I think right now the ecumenical relationship between the churches is strong. And I think that they've come out with a plan, an action plan for peace, which has three components to it. The first component is creating neutral spaces for dialogue. These neutral spaces are to go to local communities who are traumatized, who are living through what's happened to them in terms of war and conflict, what's happened to them in terms of the displacements, what's happened to them in terms of loss of beloved, the neighbors, friends, and what's happened to them in terms of the actual, we can say the famine right now that's sweeping the country because of the displacement, because of lack of security. People have not been able to plant and harvest as they would, plus the climate change, which is also demonstrating an impact in South Sudan. So I think that the Christian churches have renewed their relationship. They've strengthened it. And I think this new plan that they're calling the Action Plan for Peace, it's got legs, it's got feet. It's not just the ideas that talk and talk, but really creating the spaces for dialogue at the local level, even with the local chiefs, leaders, different groups of women, children, people of all ages, to try to get people to begin to talk about what is bothering them, what has happened to them, to begin to deal a little bit with the trauma that they've experienced, and to shed light, the light of faith on that trauma, so they recognize, much as probably the disciples after the resurrection, after the death and resurrection of Jesus, realized that they weren't alone, and the more they talked about it, the more they discovered commonality. I think this is what the churches are about, and that's the first part, the neutral territory, the neutral spaces. The second is advocacy, so to try to take the message of what's going to come out of these dialogues at the local level, dialogues that search for peace, reconciliation, to recreate humanity at the local level, and then to take the points of that and to present those at the international level so that appropriate measures can be taken to help the government achieve what it's promised to do in the Constitution and what it's renewed through the different processes of peace. And finally, that all of this would contribute to a groundswell of desire, the search for reconciliation among the people.
This plan has been embraced by the government itself, if I'm not mistaken.
It has, although we have to keep in mind that the government had to come up with a kind of its own plan as well, its own plan for reconciliation. And so the role of the churches, they felt that they also needed to have a plan that would accompany and that could actually reinforce anything that the government might try to do. One of the beliefs being that the church leaders, the church at the local levels, they're the ones who have tremendous contact and in general have because of their long-standing relationship and because of the nature of it being a faith community, there's a trust level that's there that creates possibility perhaps to go even a little deeper, only because people have lived for so long in an atmosphere of mistrust. And I think that this APP is to accompany the national process for dialogue and for reconciliation.
So they're well aware, though, that the church is a very important partner in building common good in the country.
I think that the one thing that's been demonstrated throughout the history of the conflicts going back to 1956 when it began, but at least to 1960 and onwards, the different leaders who were involved with the struggle were accompanied by people of the church. The people of the church were there praying with the communities. They were accompanying, even at times, praying for those who were involved directly in the struggle, praying for peace, that there could be a peaceful solution, encouraging the movement to continue, not necessarily with violence, but to search always to try to bring about the conditions for a permanent peace. And I think that the role of the church was absolutely essential leading up to, in 2011, with the founding of the new nation. And I think the role of the church internationally as well, the churches internationally, throughout the whole peace process, the Catholic Church in the United States with ecumenical partners, we were deeply involved through every stage of the peace process. And so I think, keep in mind, the church, the government knows the role of the church that the church has played, and also knows that the church has this link with the people. I just pray that the government can come perhaps to appreciate a little bit more and continue to work more closely with the churches in promoting this process of peace, the dialogue, and the search for the common good.
Speaking to the Bishop of Ye, he was pointing out that the first thing a man of the church does is to try and save lives as well. And he was referring directly to the famine and to the fact that Pope Francis made an appeal just last week asking for concrete aid in some of the worst stricken areas. Do you know if that's arriving, if people are finally beginning to take notice?
I think that the international community was already aware of this. The United Nations is present on the ground, its mission there, and it's been pleading at the level of the United Nations, the international community, through the World Food Program and other tools that has at its availability, talking directly with governments. So the international community has been searching to do three things, I think. Number one, to respond immediately to the crisis. Number two, to encourage the government to, together with everyone on the ground, to try to stabilize the situation, the search for peace and dialogue, and then eventually to help the people, I would hope, be able to return to their homes and to their fields where they'd be able to cultivate. Some of this is not going to change the course. This is where the difficulty, because we have an intersection here of human elements contributing to a crisis, but also there's a contribution to the natural environment as well. This moment when there's been a tremendous dryness, there's been lack of rains sufficient to be able to maintain conditions for good agricultural production. So I think there's human instability, insecurity, and the natural situation with the climate. These three things have kind of come together in a tsunami type of effect. But I think the people are grateful for what the Pope has asked for. It complements other activities that are ongoing, and I hope that the government will continue to allow food aid to be able to get to the people who are most in need.
You were speaking of a very resilient people, although traumatized. Every time I go to Africa, it strikes me how welcoming they are, notwithstanding the huge problems they have.
I think the one word that stands out that repeats itself in all the languages of South Sudan, no matter when you've arrived, if you've been there for a short time and when you're leaving, and it is the word welcome. Welcome, welcome. This is a word that is very powerful, I think, in the different identities, the different ethnic groups in South Sudan, the whole call to be a people of hospitality. Although having said that, it becomes very difficult to be a person of hospitality if you don't have a home. If you're living in a camp, POC, the protection camp for civilians, if you're on the run, if you're living in northern Uganda. The government has been very helpful there in Uganda, but at the same time, the conditions are dire, even in the camps. If they return to the Republic of Sudan, to Khartoum and to Omdurman, where they have no idea what the conditions will be from day to day, because they have not been felt welcome there, but they don't see other options. If they return to Kakuma in northern Kenya, the government of Kenya has been most welcoming over the years, but the conditions are extreme. I talked to a person of the church who's working there, and he told me that people are coming back, but they're coming back with a sense, a little bit of exhaustion, existential exhaustion. They have no more energy to run. And I think this is something, and the people even who are staying, who have not left, is simply, I think, in part because they are just exhausted. So I think that while the welcoming continues, while the hospitality will always be there, I think that there's also an edge right now. And people don't know how, they'll continue to welcome as they have, always have, but they're getting to the point where they have, other than themselves, they have nothing else to offer. Because every time they have to run, they lose everything. This is why it's so urgent that absolutely every effort be made, even as the food support comes in, but every effort be made by the government, with the help of the church and churches and the different other groups, and even the Muslim presence, the small Muslim presence in South Sudan, but even they make their contribution, that everyone with the international community really focus on what is it that's going to take to be able to arrive at a sustainable peace.
That was Father Michael Perry, Minister General of the Order of the Friars Minor, speaking to Linda Bordoni. A review of some Lenten hymns whose choral tunes were arranged by Johann Sebastian Bach is the focus of this musical reflection by Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian and rector of the Venerable English College in Rome.
Now is the healing time decreed for sins of heart, of word, or deed. That's exactly what Lent is, a time of healing, when we prepare to celebrate the Paschal mystery with minds and hearts renewed. The words of this hymn began life in Latin in the 12th century, or maybe even earlier. Ecce tempus idoneum, now is the favorable time. The music is a German chorale tune. And what I want to do this week is to talk about some lesser-known Lenten hymns, all using German chorale tunes arranged by Johann Sebastian Bach. Listen now to Bach's setting of the melody we heard just now. He uses it not for a Lenten hymn, but for a Christmas cantata. Das neugeborene Kinderlein, the newborn child. In the years after the Reformation, German composers used chorale melodies all the time in their organ music and in their choral music. An earlier generation of composers would have used Gregorian chant melodies in much the same way. For Bach, these chorale melodies were the heart and soul of his church music. The next hymn I want to play for you is based on one of Bach's favourite chorale tunes. It's an anguished prayer to our Lord as he undergoes his passion. Our holy Jesus, how hast thou offended?
Our holy Jesus, how hast thou offended?
The original text was again a Latin one, written in the 11th century. We've been listening to a 19th century English translation by the poet Robert Bridges. Bridges produced quite a few hymn texts, some of them original, like All My Hope on God is Founded, but many of them translations of earlier hymns, like this one. Bach knew this hymn as Herz liebster Jesu, and he used it in his St. Matthew Passion. The Passion narrative is interspersed with chorales intended for the congregation to sing. This one comes very early on, as soon as Jesus says to his disciples, "After 2 days it will be Passover, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." A more joyful chorale melody that sometimes sung as a Lenten hymn is the tune known as Innsbruck. It actually began life as a popular song, "O Innsbruck, I Must Leave Thee." With only a few small changes, it was transformed from a popular song into a hymn, "O World, I Now Must Leave Thee." Bach used the tune several times with different texts. In his St. John Passion, he uses it to the words, "Wer hat dich so geschlagen?" Who was it who struck you so? During Lent, as we pray for healing and forgiveness, we reflect on the sufferings of our Lord, endured for our sakes, endured so that sins might be forgiven, so that we could be reconciled with God and live forever in union with Him, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian, for that Lenten reflection, produced by Veronica Scaresbrick. And finally, why is the church so rich? Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, a priest from the Archdiocese of Liverpool, reflects on this awkward question he often gets asked by people. It's a question that perhaps has even more resonance in this austere season of Lent, with its emphasis on fasting and almsgiving.
One of my jobs as a priest has been to teach philosophy. It would be more accurate to say to try to teach philosophy, because in the Anglo-Saxon and Celtic world, people get impatient with what seems to be pure theory, with no obvious practical purpose. But my father used to have a pub in Wales where I had to work serving beer and other drinks whenever I was home. It is utterly amazing how philosophical people become when they have had just a little too much to drink. They will argue about almost anything and take themselves really seriously. It is wise not to disagree with them. One of the things people frequently say when their inhibitions are not holding them back is how shocked they are that the Catholic Church is so rich. Everyone seems very impressed by figures in the history of the Church like St. Francis of Assisi or Mother Teresa. But I often get the impression from what they say that I am part of an organisation that has betrayed its origins. Why is the Church so rich? Why doesn't the Vatican sell its treasures? Isn't it going against what Jesus taught? Why do you bother staying in such a hypocritical church? These are questions I often hear, and they need an honest answer. The first thing I feel bound to say is that there is always room for improvement in the church. It is very easy to spot church officials with brand new cars and fashionable clothing, those who choose expensive restaurants and have exotic holidays. The best thing is to learn from them. If that sort of behaviour makes us uneasy or unhappy, then we should obviously not imitate them if we're ever in their situation. Secondly, example is much more powerful than criticism. As far as I know, St. Francis himself was far more interested in living his own poverty than denouncing other people's faults and failings. Thirdly, Thank God, such opulent church officials are a tiny minority. And fourthly, if restraint in living standards applies to the officials in the church, it applies to everyone. Luckily, I know many people, even priests, who regularly give substantial amounts to charities. I wonder what people mean when they say the Catholic Church is so rich, because we look more united than we really are. Different orders and congregations and movements are all separate entities as far as money is concerned. Every diocese is a totally separate economic unit, and every parish has to run its own separate accounts. In some places, sharing schemes enable richer parishes to help poorer ones. And on the international level, the bishops in some countries pool money and other resources on behalf of poorer Catholic communities in other countries, and they do so gladly. Some parts of the church are wealthy, but many struggle. Many are very generous. What about selling the Vatican art collections? I wonder what good that would do. Now, they are visited and enjoyed by hundreds of thousands of people every year, and I believe the entrance fees simply cover the running costs and restoration work. If they were sold, that would end tomorrow. The money could be given to good causes, but only once. I hope we're not going against the spirit of what Jesus wanted his followers to do. I would jump for joy if bureaucracy could be reduced, and if we could solve some more major problems, but we are very limited. I have no idea what is hidden in bank accounts, but I'm convinced that is not where the church's real riches lie. It is a tonic to visit Lourdes and see the amount of goodness poured out on the sick, very often by young women and men whose generosity is not often recognised at home. It is marvellous to see young lay men and women volunteering for a period of service in foreign countries with little or no pay. It is impressive to see the energy expended by missionary sisters, brothers and priests, who think of many things but never of money. And I'm proud to have been involved in the formation of some young men who give hours and hours every day to their work in hospitals, prisons and schools. They are paid and generally want for little, but the good ones seem almost unconcerned about what they're given. These people, whose services the Christian community receives very cheaply, are witnesses of very important values. That is why I think it is worth bothering with our imperfect but humanly genuine church. Just two final thoughts. We must never forget how Jesus reacted to people doing business in the temple. We must do our utmost to ensure that, at every level, the church lives honestly and simply. Finally, if they did sell the Vatican art collection, I wonder if the profit from the sale would be enough to pay for one of the more expensive football players in Italy or England.
Thanks there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood from the Archdiocese of Liverpool in England for that reflection. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.